This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. While the photographs from Abu Ghraib remain the most dramatic evidence of detainee abuse, additional allegations of mistreatment continued to surface over the past several months. The Bush administration maintains that, by and large, this has been a case of a few bad apples, not the product of Pentagon policy. Now a new set of documents challenges that position. Using the Freedom of Information Act, the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups found thousands of emails and memoranda, some from FBI agents who provided detailed descriptions of abusive tactics by military interrogators at Guantanamo Bay. Some prisoners were denied food and water for more than a day, they wrote. Others chained to the ground in compromising positions. And there's more. Taken together, the documents suggest that mistreatment of foreign detainees was more common than originally thought. Some captors claimed they were following orders straight from the office of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Later in the program, the big caper in Belfast that sounds an awful lot like a movie script. But first, the widening allegations of prisoner abuse. If you have questions about what happened and where, or about where the trail of responsibility may go, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. To begin, we turn to Jan Egan of the Washington Post. He's been reporting on this story. He's with us from his home here in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Tell us what we've learned in this new, huge number of documents.
Well, in just this week, there are two main large groups of documents. The first came from the FBI and detailed both correspondence between FBI agents and FBI field offices and that sort of thing, as well as some summaries provided by some FBI agents of what they had seen at Guantanamo Bay. The FBI has been rotating agents in and out of Guantanamo Bay and other detention facilities in sort of a mostly an advisory capacity, as far as we're able to tell. They are often not able to take part in the interrogations because the rules governing military interrogations go beyond what the FBI is allowed to do.
Mm-hmm. There's another group of documents that describes more abuses in Iraq.
Right. It gives us more detail, a fuller picture of some examples of allegations involving detainees throughout Iraq, also not just at Abu Ghraib, and in fact, mostly not at Abu Ghraib, but at many other locations, both in the field and in other detention facilities.
And what, as you look at these overall, what do they suggest to you?
Well, I mean, I think I think it's fair to say that as more and more documents come out describing different kinds of abuse and at or questionable tactics, we should say. And at more locations, the Guantanamo revelations, I think, were particularly important because there's been the administration has maintained and been quite adamant in maintaining that there were no similar problems at Guantanamo Bay, problems similar to those seen in Iraq, and these certainly call into question those assertions, and that's probably their main the main importance.
And throughout all of this, the administration, first responding to Abu Ghraib, said, "Well, this was a case of a few bad apples." I believe the general in command of that military police unit was given administrative punishment, but the only trials proceeding, the court martials, are those of people that's rank of sergeant and below. The case of a few bad apples, that stance seems to be under question now too.
Yes, I would say so. that said, what is still a mystery to some extent is how high up it goes, as it were. There clearly, from many of the emails and documents, it certainly seems clear that there was widespread confusion in the field over what the rules were, and an assumption about what the rules were, in some cases based on rules that were put out by the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. And so that raises questions about, you know, what those, if those policies were, you know, went too far, and if they were had the effect of condoning behavior that may not have been appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And there's that situation. There's also the situation of it appears that many soldiers and Marines were disciplined for these lapses, but most of them were internal, private punishments and not court-martials that would have been made public.
Right, exactly. And they were, there are certainly allegations from the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups. The ACLU is the group that brought the lawsuit that has been resulting in these disclosures.
Mm-hmm.
And they and others certainly feel that a lot of these cases are questionable in terms of how they were handled, how they came out. One instance that came out yesterday, there was an incident with an Army specialist who shot and killed an Iraqi prisoner in Tikrit in August of 2003, I believe it was. And the Army's Criminal Investigative Division determined that there was probable cause to charge this person with murder, but instead he was demoted and discharged, and it sort of went, they did a rapid kind of process that essentially went around the longer process of charging him with murder.
So administrative punishment, again,
correct.
Not a court-martial that would have been made
correct.
Public.
Correct.
How have the White House and the Pentagon responded to these new documents?
Well, yesterday the White House spokesman, Scott McClellan, said very adamantly and strongly that the president and the administration expected these allegations to be fully investigated, and that they were taken seriously, and he and others in the administration said that that some of the documents underscored how they did take these things seriously, because they did in fact investigate allegations and that sort of thing. But I think particularly some of the documents on Monday were that seemed to come as a surprise to at least the White House. And I think we're particularly damaging in that these are FBI agents simply describing what they saw.
Mm-hmm.
That is a lot different than, say, an allegation from a detainee who may have an axe to grind or a motive, with muddled witness accounts and that kind of thing. I mean, these are, presumably, these are trained law enforcement officers who are describing what they witnessed.
And as opposed to the, it would have been easy to have the impression that a mere handful of soldiers had been facing discipline up to a few weeks ago, it now appears that more than 130 American troops have been punished or charged in cases involving the abuse of prisoners.
Right, right.
Yeah. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Juan, who's on the line with us from Medford, New York.
Hi. My question is, if this goes up really high in the chain of command, what's going to happen with those people who are being court-martialed now and being charged? And it gets pretty serious things if they were just following orders.
You are certainly anticipating what any good defense lawyer would. One argument that any good defense lawyer would make. We don't know of the existence of any rules that condone a lot of this specific behavior. There's no, at least nothing has come to light, in the Defense Department saying that you can chain and shackle people in a fetal position to the floor, to the concrete floor for, 24 hours or more, deprive them of food, et cetera. That seems to go against all the rules, for example. Those were incidents that were described as having occurred at Guantanamo Bay, for example. So some of these, and it is hard to parse a lot of this, there are so many different incidents with different variations that, you have to determine where that line is. Some stuff is that has been widely described again in the recent documents has been confirmed to have been widely done were allowed under Defense Department rules, such as use of various psychological tactics or lights and flashing lights and that kind of thing. So it's kind of, and I don't know that people are being nobody's being court-martialed for those kinds of things. They're being court-martialed or disciplined for actions that are clearly outside what is written down on paper as the rules.
Thank you for your answer.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Juan.
I hope that made sense.
Joining us now is Anthony Romero, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. He's with us by phone from his office in New York City. Nice of you to take time to be with us today.
Delighted. Thank you.
And just to clarify, the ACLU filed suit with other groups?
Yes, that's right. We were involved with this litigation going all the way back to June of 2003, actually, when we first filed our request under the Freedom of Information Act.
And you've received some 9,000 pages of government documents up till now, and I understand you expect to get more.
Yes, we expect to get more. And I think what's notable to underscore about the timing of when we first initiated this inquiry was that that was before the entire Abu Ghraib situation came to light. And much of what Mr. Egan, who's done a terrific job in the newspapers of the Washington Post, describing the evolution of the information which has come out by drips and drabs, with the American government fighting us tooth and nail every step of the way about the release of these documents or the need to answer these questions before a federal court.
And I should also explain that many of these documents have been the terminology's redacted. In other words, names have been blacked out, and some information, obviously, you don't know what it is. A lot of stuff has been blacked out.
That's correct. And we're trying to connect the dots as best as we can, given some of the gaps, both in memos that have not been turned over and gaps in the memos that have been turned over. But what is clear, though, when you connect the dots, is that torture is happening. That torture is happening at the hands of government officials, of soldiers. That it's not the actions of a couple of rogue soldiers or the aberrant behavior of a few, but it's much more widespread and raising much more the questions around systemic problems in the military, the confusion that Mr. Egan referenced before, that even members on the ground were not clear about what rules or regulations or executive orders were or were not enacted, what powers they were or were not given, and demonstrating also the rift between some elements of the federal government, including the FBI and the Department of Defense. I mean, that's perhaps one of the most breathtaking recognitions of all of these memos. It's the fact that the FBI has been raising these concerns throughout the crisis, and that they're, in fact, that FBI officials were concerned about being left holding the bag, as one of them quoted, because you had Department of Defense interrogators dressing up as FBI officials. This impersonation technique as a way for them to escape responsibility for any of the harsh interrogation techniques that are being used, or the torture techniques, as even one FBI memo describes it.
Yeah. Dan Egan, words are important in this respect. You don't use the word torture.
Well, I mean, obviously that's a subjective word, but there are many people, including those at the ACLU, who believe that's the case, and I think, without getting into a semantic debate, there's no doubt that much of this behavior described in these documents certainly goes over the line of what most people would consider to be reasonable, even in a time of war. Some of the actions would seem to violate international norms on torture, and therefore may be defined as torture by international law.
Mr. Egan is being a great journalist, making sure that he reports the facts and not editorializing the facts. I am an advocate. I can editorialize. And I don't think there's any way that anyone who's looking at these documents, who's not in the profession of the media, cannot draw the conclusion this is in torture. For instance, when you put lit cigarette butts in the ears of a detainee, when they're held in strangulation holds, when they're detained 18, 24 hours, to the floor and defecate and urinate on themselves. When a man's hands is doused, hands are doused in alcohol and lit afire, I think that that the public will draw the conclusion it needs to draw, that this is completely anathema to both domestic and the concern for international law. And the point that Mr. Egan makes is exactly right, that the responsibility, although we have not the smoking gun yet being held in the hands of Mr. Rumsfeld or the White House, and I underscore the word yet. What is clear is that memos written all the way up to the White House counsel's office questioned whether or not the president would be able.
I'm going to have to cut you off there because we're going to have to take a short break. We'll continue this conversation afterwards. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the implication of new documents made public recently that describe abuse of foreign detainees in Iraq, Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Our guests are Dan Egan, a reporter with the Washington Post who's been covering this story. Also with us is Anthony Romero, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, one of the organizations that filed suit to make these documents public. Of course, you're invited to join us. 800-989-8255. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. And let's get another caller involved. This is Barnett, who's with us from Schuyler, Iowa.
How do you do?
Barnett, go ahead.
Yes. I'm not going to try to condone any actions that we've done that are inappropriate, especially according to the Geneva Convention. I'm just a little curious about the ACLU because they're not one of my favorite groups anyway. Why are they not making a stink about when they take us prisoner, they lop our heads off? We're worried about wrapping a flag around them and giving them a little bit of humiliation. I mean, I don't see the comparison.
Well, part of the reason why, sir, we are raising the concerns about what the U.S. government does with detainees it has in its custody is that the only thing that protects our men and women in uniform when they are arrested by enemy forces, the only thing that allows us to have any comfort to know that perhaps they might be treated humanely and in concert with international law, is the existence and our respect for the rule of law. So when we trample on the rule of law on detainees in Guantanamo and Iraq, we put our own men and women in uniform at risk. And that's part of the reason why I think the outcry from members of the military has been so significant, that there are many members of the military who, regardless of their political ideology, believe that it was wrongheaded for this administration to question the application of the Geneva Conventions, for instance, and the memos written to and by Mr. Gonzalez, White House counsel, who is now the Attorney General nominee, that puts our own men and women in uniform very much at risk. Okay. And that's the point we've been raising in our work.
Okay, philosophically, I agree with you. However, in practicality, that ideology doesn't seem to play because, for example, it doesn't matter how well we treat them or how poorly they treat them. They're going to treat us the same way no matter what. Just as the same scenario where we go in there worrying about civilian casualties, and we took very few civilian casualties. We made every effort to avoid it. It really doesn't matter whether we kill one or 1,000 because Al Jazeera is going to report that we killed 1,000 anyway.
Barnett, thank you very much for the call. And let me, Anthony Romero, put his question another way. Critics, as you know, have charged that by focusing on Abu Ghraib, on allegations of prisoner abuse, the ACLU, and they're more than happy to toss the media into this as well, are tarnishing our soldiers who are at war, men and women who are fighting and dying overseas.
Not at all. Not at all. I think the men and women in uniform who we've spoken with, who understand and who have been trained and respect the rule of law, appreciate the fact that what we do helps protect their lives when they're on the line. And in fact, when we raise these questions about what's happening in the military, we raise the questions about how much the responsibility goes up the chain of command, and that it's not just the actions of a few rogue soldiers, but in fact there's high-level statements and perhaps implicit or explicit policies that have created confusion on the ground about what is and is not acceptable, I think that only helps protect our soldiers and make us stronger as a nation. I understand very much the concern that the gentleman raises from Iowa about what are we fighting for, but we got to remind ourselves we're fighting for core American values. And if we erode those core values at this time, then we're no better than the terrorists. And we don't want to be that.
Let's take a call now from Shell, who's with us from Castro Valley in California.
Yeah, I was wondering what the constitutional allowances are for treatment of prisoners, because the Bush administration had hired lawyers to look in to see what superseded international law. And I had a couple other questions, too, but that's my main one.
Yeah. It's a good question for you to put, especially to, I think, the next guest that will be also on the NPR program, who's one of the authors of a memo that was given to Attorney General, White House Counsel Alberto Gonzalez, Mr. John Yoo, where he says in his memo that both international law and customary law and the constitutional law, the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, do not apply in the current context, in the current conflict. That raises very serious doubts about whether or not you can create an island outside of the law in which the executive is given this blank check over the rights of detainees or individuals.
And even my personal belief is that I think it's obvious that it went up to the administration, the president's administration, when he's, rather than trying to investigate, he's trying to find laws that would, you know, make it okay.
Well, that request preceded any of these violations or alleged violations.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Shell. We appreciate it.
Yeah, if I could jump in here, I think the both of the last two questions kind of bring up a broader issue, which is, again, this confusion issue. And you know, the administration certainly hasn't helped itself because it has put out documents suggesting that, for example, the Geneva Conventions may not apply to the war on terrorism. And the so-called torture memo from the Justice Department, which was then disavowed when it was when it came to light publicly. So they've been sending a lot of mixed messages. There are frequent proclamations that they are abiding by international norms, that they will investigate any allegations of abuse, et cetera. While at the same time, you know, they're downplaying and saying it's very isolated. After the famous photographs came out, it was just a few soldiers, and obviously we're seeing that it's a broader problem than that. So there is both sort of a credibility gap and a general level of confusion as to what really were the rules, what are the rules, and who is communicating those rules to the folks in the field who have to deal with them.
It seems exactly the moment we should bring in our next guest. But first, Dan Egan, let me thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Dan Egan covers the Justice Department and the FBI for the Washington Post. He joined us by phone from his home in Washington. Anthony Romero, we thank you for your time today as well.
My pleasure.
Anthony Romero, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, joined us by phone from his office in New York City. And now joining us is John Yoo, Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley, formerly a lawyer with the Justice Department under President Bush. And as we heard, John Yoo, first of all, thank you as always for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, Neil, thanks a lot for having me on again. It's a pleasure.
And I wanted to ask you about, I know you've been listening to the last couple of minutes of the program, and exactly the point that the caller raised and that was addressed by Anthony Romero of the ACLU on this point of presidential, how did you phrase it?
Well, I think your caller phrased it as, you know, as a president, has he overridden the Constitution in some way in the treatment of detainees? And let me just say, I think there's some exaggeration and confusion about the different legal regimes that apply here. No one is saying that the Constitution doesn't apply to the president in the conduct of war, but the war has war raises different rules under the Constitution. Just to give you some examples, for example, detention itself in our criminal justice system is something that's a punishment after you've been tried in a civilian court. In the laws of war, you detain members of the enemy not as a punishment, but to stop them from fighting, to prevent them from being a future harm, and then you release them when the war is over. So I think it's not the case that the Constitution doesn't apply to the president. It's just that the war and the laws of war apply differently. And then the other source, I think, here of misunderstanding is that we're fighting two different wars from a legal perspective here. One is the war on terrorism against al-Qaeda, and then the other one is the war in Iraq. And for the former, the Geneva Conventions, the administration has said clearly, do not legally apply. And that's because al-Qaeda is not a member, is not a nation. It didn't sign the Geneva Conventions. And everything al-Qaeda does violates the core rules of the laws of war. They attack civilians. They don't wear uniforms. They attack by surprise. The war in Iraq, however, is clearly covered by the Geneva Conventions. And so there are a lot of legal protections for detainees in Iraq in the way they're treated.
Wasn't there an argument at one point, and I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that the president's authority as commander-in-chief in certain circumstances overrode the Geneva Convention, which, of course, has been ratified by the United States Senate as a treaty?
Well, first of all, I don't think that was stated in any of the memos that the president actually had to. But I think he does if there was an extreme circumstance. The actual argument I think that's being – well, let me first address this. The Geneva Conventions are a treaty, and the president can terminate treaties unilaterally, just as President Bush terminated the ABM treaty, just as President Carter terminated the mutual defense treaty with Taiwan in the 70s, in both cases without Senate consent. So if it ever came to it – and the president obviously has never – had to make that choice. The president has never said that he feels it's necessary to do this. But if it ever came to that, you know, the president, in protecting the national security, could terminate our signature to the Geneva Conventions. But no one's ever suggested that was necessary or decided to do anything like that. Mm-hmm. What I think has been raised is actually whether the president can override the criminal statute prohibiting torture abroad against detainees or actually anyone, and that's a serious constitutional question. You know, this question of can Congress actually prevent the president as commander in chief from waging war in certain ways? This is a question that's been with us since President Lincoln, for example. And President Lincoln thought, and by his actions, believed that in extreme circumstances, when the country is under attack, the president's constitutional authority as commander in chief allowed him to take actions without congressional permission. And so, in this other area, in this these memos that were released last year.
Mm-hmm.
That's the question that came up. If, suppose there was an extreme circumstance, a ticking time bomb or atomic bomb, unfortunately, these days, suppose we had a terrorist leader who we thought knew where a bomb was located in American City, could the president, under those extreme circumstances, override a criminal statute and have that person interrogated to find out where that bomb was? And I said, in that extreme circumstance, I think the president could do that. Now, the Justice Department pulled that back because it said that was purely hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
No one had ever had to consider that and wasn't a question that was really under consideration at the time.
The memos that you were involved in writing were narrowly drawn, addressed to specific circumstances, yet this new raft of documents appears to indicate that a lot of people in the military, in the special forces, various places around the world had come to the conclusion that either the White House or the Defense Department had given the green light to extreme tactics, many of which, as you read the documents, come off sounding like torture.
Well, I have to say, first of all, I haven't gone through all the documents that have been obtained by the ACLU. I've seen some of them. I've seen some of the media reports. And I think, one point that's clear is that the military itself has investigated these actions. It's mm-hmm. not that there's been some – and I think that's an important point to make. I think there's a difference between cases where individuals go beyond their authorization and do things they weren't supposed to do, things that were illegal or unauthorized, and arguing that there's some kind of general policy that's been imposed from above ordering people to commit abuse against prisoners. As far as I can tell, and from everything I've seen and everything I participated in, no one in the leadership of the government ever said, we're going to engage in physical abuse. Instead, what they've always said is be aggressive, but be within the law. Be forward-leaning, but stay within what the law permits. And so I think what you're seeing so far are cases where people went beyond their authorization, particularly in Iraq. In Iraq, where the Geneva Conventions apply, there's no doubt that physical abuse is prohibited against prisoners who are captured in that conflict. I think what you have are cases where individuals went beyond their authorization and the military is properly investigating and conducting. But that doesn't mean you should get rid of interrogation overall. It's sort of like saying, we have a lot of cases of abuse by prison guards in this country, but that doesn't mean you would get rid of the prison system because you have cases where people did things that were illegal.
We're speaking with John Yu, a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley, previously a lawyer with the Justice Department in the Bush administration. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Dan. Dan's calling from San Diego.
Yes, I have two quick questions to direct to the learned gentleman. First of all, I would like to know when President Bush went to the Congress and asked for a declaration of war empowering the war, enabling the War Powers Act. And secondly, I want to say that how does these abuses and getting this information help us in our war in Iraq when we're supposed to be on the moral high ground? We're supposed to be America, that we're supposed to be teaching them that our way is better, when what we're doing is merely doing what Saddam Hussein did. And they see that on Al Jazeera and say, why? Why did we do this? I'm going to join the resistance. I think it's extremely counterproductive and destroying our core values as well.
Well, Dan, I think those are both very good and fair questions. Let me say first on your more technical question, the president did go to Congress and received an authorization to use force against anyone connected with the September 11th attacks. He got that authorization on September 18th. It was enacted by large majorities of Congress. It wasn't a declaration of war. It was a statute. Most people think the two were interchangeable. I might add he also received one in the lead up to the war against Iraq as well.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of your second question, I think that's a fair question. Let me say two things. First is, there is no policy to commit torture. There's no policy to commit physical abuse in Iraq amongst our troops. I think the administration has made very clear that there's to be no physical abuse. It's unfortunate and deplorable that things like Abu Ghraib and what we're seeing now may have happened. Of course, we're having investigations going forward to see exactly what happened and who should be held responsible. But I think there is a fundamental difference between Saddam Hussein and the United States. Saddam Hussein used torture and things like this as a policy, and he killed hundreds of thousands of people. The United States, I think, is properly treating these things as aberrations and abuses, and they're investigating and punishing people
if you've
who
got,
commit these crimes.
Excuse me just a second, Dan. If you've got scores of soldiers and Marines who've been punished for this, as well as the people up on trial, when does a few cases begin to develop into something that the gentleman from the ACLU called systematic?
That's a very good question, and I think that's why we've got these three military investigations going. I think two of them already – actually four. Three of them have come through Taguba, Fay, and the Schlesinger reports. Mm-hmm. None of them found so far that there was any kind of policy.
But did they have access to these documents that have been freshly published?
No, in fact, I don't think that they did. I mean, my impression is that, prison guards in Abu Ghraib were not poring over the legal opinions that were being issued by the Justice Department or the Defense Department. I think rather what you have – look, you have an enormous organization and institution in Iraq that's fighting a war under extremely difficult circumstances. And let me also – this goes to Dan's question also. Intelligence is key, particularly actually for the war against al-Qaeda, which attacks by surprise and they attack civilians. Getting intelligence from people we capture is probably the only way we have to stop those kind of terrorist attacks. Mm-hmm. In Iraq, the demand for intelligence obviously is also great. We're not trying to stop attacks in the United States, but we are trying to stop attacks on our own troops. And so there is an important need, I think, for interrogation to get that information to stop future attacks on our forces and on the homeland of the United States. So in those circumstances, I think that the administration has said is be aggressive but stay within the law. I don't think there's been any policy. I'm pretty sure none of the reports have found any policy issued by people in Washington to engage in this kind of abuse. Instead, I think you have a big organization, institution in Iraq, where people have gone over the line in certain circumstances. I remember we have over 160,000 troops there, and some people are going to make mistakes.
Dan, we just have a few seconds left. If you have a very quick follow-up.
Yes, you're asking a uneducated, largely illiterate population to make a very fine distinction between our actions and Saddam Hussein's actions. Our actions speak thousands times more than our words do.
Thank you, Dan.
So making a policy makes no difference.
All right, Dan. John Yoo, if you want 10 seconds to respond to that, you can have it.
Again, I think there's a big difference in what's happening. There's no policy here. And I think what's important is that our authorities are actually investigating and punishing people who commit these kind of abuses. I think it's a demonstration of our great governmental system that these abuses are actually being discussed publicly, are being made public, and that we're responding in the proper way to pursue them.
John Yoo, professor of law at the University of California, as always, thank you so much. I know this is not easy conversations. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure.
John, you joined us from the studios on the Berkeley campus. We'll have more on this when we come back from a break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about fresh allegations of abuse against foreign detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in Iraq, and Afghanistan. Joining us now is Scott Horton, chairman of the International Law Committee for the New York City Bar Association. Mr. Horton has consulted with lawyers from the Pentagon and the Justice Department regarding the treatment of foreign prisoners. He's with us from NPR's Bureau in New York City. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Neil.
First of all, when did you first become aware of federal policy on the treatment of detainees? And, of course, we're talking about the current context.
Well, it was in May of 2003 when at the Bar Association I was visited by a delegation of very senior uniformed military lawyers who told us that a series of horrendous policy decisions had been made by senior people at the Pentagon that was going to lead to abuse of detainees. They were very concerned about it. They thought it was going to damage the country's reputation.
So these were JAG officers, Judge Advocate General Corps.
That's correct.
And these are the people who would be assigned to defend these detainees.
Defend and prosecute and sit in judgment.
So their concern was, I guess, the result of what we've since learned to describe as the torture memos?
I think it followed from the torture memos. And indeed, I was just preceded by the principal author of the main torture memo, Professor Yoo.
And obviously, he would not describe it as such, but these officers were concerned that implementation of some of the ideas contained in those memos would result in abusive detainees.
Absolutely, and they said a number of other peripheral decisions had been made which would create an environment, a conscious environment, that was going to lead to abuse. That had been opposed by senior military and had been pushed through over their opposition by political figures in the Pentagon.
And why did they come to you?
They wanted to get the American Bar Association, the legal profession as a whole, engaged on these issues and raising the policy questions, which in fact happened, but to no avail.
Mm-hmm. Now, since then, obviously, a great deal has come out, beginning with Abu Ghraib and most recently these new memos and emails, some of which were published this week. Do you see a pattern of misconduct? Do you see, Professor, you said he did not see a systematic policy. What do you see?
I think there's no question about it. These documents clearly demonstrate policy decisions taken at the top of the government that lead directly to the abuses in question. And in fact, Professor Yu said that there was no evidence in the prior internal investigations that suggested that policies were involved. That's a false statement. Very clearly, the Faye Jones report concluded that a number of the mistaken judgments, the rules of engagement issued by Lieutenant General Sanchez, rested upon Sanchez's understanding of memoranda written by Professor Yu and Judge Gonzalez. And beyond that, Major General Taguba and his report also said a series of major false policy decisions, which had been pressed upon the military from high up above, led to the disaster at Abu Ghraib.
Just to clarify a couple of names, Ricardo Sanchez was the lieutenant general, then in a senior position of command in Iraq, in command of all soldiers, I believe, in Iraq. Judge Gonzalez is now, of course, the man who's been nominated to be next Attorney General of the United States.
Correct.
And do you expect that these allegations are going to play a role in his confirmation hearing?
I'm sure of it. In fact, I would say the number one question that's going to be put to Judge Gonzalez is his role in authorizing and requesting the torture memoranda. I mean, we know from these documents, they say in the transmittal letters that they were requested by Judge Gonzalez. And of course, Judge Gonzalez himself is the author of the memorandum that belittled the Geneva Conventions as quaint and obsolete.
Other than being privy to some of these questions by the JAG officers and the conclusions that you've reached, is the American Bar Association doing anything about this?
Well, the American Bar Association on August 5th passed a series of resolutions in the House of Delegates in which we condemned the torture memoranda as incompetent and incorrect. We raised serious questions about the professional ethics of the lawyers who were involved in preparing these memoranda, and we called on the administration to step back from an obvious series of policy decisions that were fostering torture and abuse of detainees.
Now, that is a conclusion at which you've arrived. The gentleman from the ACLU that we had on earlier said there is as yet no smoking gun.
I think they're right that there's no one single document that clearly puts a nail in the coffin, but the circumstantial case is overwhelming at this point.
Let's get a caller on the line. Jeffrey's with us from Gilbertsville, Kentucky.
Yes, I have a question, and I certainly am a supporter of the ACLU, and I'm glad they're there. I guess I have two questions. If this goes to the top, up to Rumsfeld, number one, how will Rumsfeld be held accountable? Will he ever be held accountable for anything he does if it does go to that level? And if it even leads to the White House, meaning the president, is there a possibility that there could be an impeachment for this situation? And it's an honest question. I'm not in favor of the president. I'm asking that question as an honest question.
It's both a legal and a political question, but Scott Horton, why don't you go ahead?
I'm happy to answer both parts. I think we really got to start with a focus on Secretary Rumsfeld. And indeed, the latest batch of documents contain a number, particularly including a May 10 FBI memorandum that says clearly that the man making the decisions to authorize abusive treatment of detainees in Guantanamo is Donald Rumsfeld. He's identified as such. There are a number of other collateral documents that do that. So that Secretary Rumsfeld's involvement in this is now completely clear, as is the involvement of Undersecretary Steve Cambone and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, who directed some of the task force groups that are involved in some of the most serious abuses.
As you know, the Pentagon and the White House deny that. Go ahead.
That's correct. And the major question here is how you hold a civilian figure like this accountable. That's a responsibility of the Justice Department. But the dilemma we see here is how the Justice Department is going to take forward and move on this with any credibility, given its own involvement in the entire process. Clearly, this is a case where there should be an independent commission like the 9/11 Commission, which will undertake an investigation and make recommendations. And that, in fact, is what the American Bar Association called for this summer. With respect to the president, you've got the same issues, but I have to say I'm much less persuaded of a trail that links the president of the United States to the decisions to abuse detainees. And I think what the ACLU has recently trumpeted is just, in my view, thin evidence.
Scott Horton, first of all, Jeffrey, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Scott Horton, we wanted to thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Scott Horton, chairman of the International Law Committee at the New York City Bar Association, and he was with us from our bureau in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.